If you sought to provide a land map of the guiding images of the American imagination, you might come up with something that suggested a shining city on a hill set upon the golden fields of El Dorado. From first settlement to this very moment, the getting of wealth in a lushly favored land has coexisted with a concern about life's moral imperatives. The relationship has always been difficult, and it has often been tortured, even denied. What we are left with and oriented by are a series of very American stories charting the path we have taken over time across this vast terrain where money and morals meet. My guest is Patricia O'Toole, author of Money and Morals in America. Patty, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you for having me, George.
Patty, the roots of this book, so beautifully explained actually in the preface, rest in a very personal experience of yours in Washington, D.C., where you have an encounter with poverty as you are surrounded by the rather luxurious circumstances of a hotel. Now, do I take it that that individual experience was for you something of a metaphor for the kind of tension we have between money and morals in this society of ours?
Yes. What the experience was, I was staying in the Hay Adams Hotel, and everyone who's ever been to Washington probably knows this beautiful hotel. It's a block north of the White House, and what's between the White House and the hotel is Lafayette Park. And I went out early in the morning for a walk in the park, and I saw a couple of feet peeking out of bushes here and there, and then what looked to be human forms under blankets. And I thought at first, well, it was a beautiful summer night last night. Maybe these are just fresh air eccentrics. But I was curious about it, so I kept walking around the park and discovered that there were somewhere between 2 and 3 dozen people sleeping in the park. And I was shocked. I had, of course, this was the summer of 1989, and homelessness had long been with us. Anybody who's been in any big American city has seen similar scenes. But what shocked me was seeing this basically in the front yard of the White House and thinking, why should this be in the midst of all the affluence of our society? So I went back out after I had my nice breakfast in the hotel and handed out my leftovers to the two first people I saw, who happened to be two men on a bench. And I knew when I looked into their eyes that I was going to have to write a book about this. I was all wrapped up in myself when I was taking this food over there. I thought, oh, they're going to think this is some kind of Lady Bountiful thing. By then I was dressed up for my day's business. But the fact is they weren't thinking about me at all. They were so hungry. Yeah. And they just ripped into this food.
But I'm very glad that that was the moment that gave you the resolve to write the book, because I think the book is a very good service to all of us. Let's examine for a moment what is at the crux of that tension, the heart of the emotion you felt at that moment, and perhaps the heart of the book itself. And let me pose it as a question. Is it, in your view, Patty, that there is the tension is ultimately between our commitment to individual success, which we seem to prize so highly, set against a religious philosophy, a Judeo-Christian tradition we're all influenced by, that does, of course, emphasize communal aims and communal values?
I think that is the tension. It's a tension between getting mine and taking care of ours. And the reason it's a tension is that we all aspire to both of those things.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back into history, and we'll start this return to history where you start, actually. Your first chapter is on John Winthrop, who, of course, I think he did coin that phrase, the shining city on a hill, or took it from the Bible, did he? It
comes from the Gospels.
The Gospels, yeah. Exactly. And, of course, Ronald Reagan used it to effect in 1980 or so. But John Winthrop, the governor of the Massachusetts Puritan community, tried to get that community to follow the Christian injunction, love one another, which certainly sounds all to the good, and, of course, build that shining city on the hill. But the experiment runs into trouble. It runs into trouble because of political and theological challenges that grow up within the community and for other reasons. So I wonder if you, Patty, would briefly tell us what those troubles were and perhaps even more importantly, what kind of lesson we might draw from the experience of this first experience with money and morals.
Well, the first thing is to be completely dazzled by this notion that you could found a society upon the idea of love one another. Mm. I mean, wow, what an idea. And as far as I can tell, it worked for about 2 weeks. And the immediate challenge was on the practical side of things. You come to a wilderness, and there just isn't a Home Depot where you can go get all the things you need, nor are there carpenters and bricklayers around. So you have a shortage of materials and a shortage of labor, and everybody needs a house. And, mm-hmm. and so there was all kinds of bidding going on, and those who had more money were able to outbid the others and get their houses done first, and so on. So what their first way of dealing with this was a series of wage and price controls. Then John Winthrop thought that there wasn't much room for individualism. This is the part that doesn't feel so American to us anymore. Also the fact that it was a theocratic government, you know, now we have a great separation between church and state. But what kind of did in the Puritans, I think, was he invited them when they were on a ship on the way over to enter this covenant with him. And I think that when you invite people to enter a covenant, then they feel, well, okay, I'm not going to be part of it anymore when things, they feel free to leave. So the community aspect of things began to crowd out the individualistic aspect of life, and Puritans longed to move away, get, you know, over one more hill, right, or beyond the next bend in the river where they wouldn't be watched every single minute.
Your second story, I would actually give a kind of a subtitle to, because I was struck by this phrase that occurs in it, and I would call it, this is a story about James Edward Oglethorpe and Georgia. And at one point in the story, we'll come to, I'm sure, in our conversation, the one thing needful, as a phrase comes up, that one thing needful, of course, being slavery. But in 1729, Colonel James Edward Oglethorpe gets disenchanted with the state of English society, and particularly its treatment of debtors, and resolves to form, as he does, a colony in Georgia that's going to be, well, I think, as you phrased it, something of a clockwork universe in terms of the way that people relate to each other and the way he runs it. Now, once again, things start out well, proceed well for a time, but eventually problems of morals arise in the sense that this empire of personal responsibility that Oglethorpe founded and wanted to run becomes a slaveocracy. How did that happen? I mean, what was the failure? What would cause something so idealistically established to degenerate to that point?
Well, in a fundamental way, it's a real estate problem. They made the mistake. Georgia, the colony of Georgia on paper was one of the best ideas I've ever read. They thought, okay, we have all these poor people in England with no opportunities for them. Let's export them to Georgia, give everybody 500 acres and a chance to start fresh. Certainly they're going to know a better life than they know in England. The mistake they made was imagining that these people would be so self-sacrificing that they would be willing to put up with hardship for decades on end. And the second mistake was starting the colony in what became the town of Savannah, which is right across the river from South Carolina, where slavery was well established. The original idea was not to have slavery in Georgia, but the Georgians had the bad example of the South Carolinians right across the river. And South Carolinians would come visiting in Georgia, and they'd bring their slaves with them. And to somebody who was pecking in the dirt, you know, and seeing, oh, if I only had slaves to do this hard work in the sun, there was just kind of no contest. I've often wondered what would have happened if they had set the colony, say, somewhere farther west in Georgia, where they didn't have the example of slavery around them, whether they then would have turned out to be a society of small farmers, which was the original hope. But the conditions were so hard that the Georgians just didn't see any way of getting ahead. And with this bad example, they thought that was of slavery. Yeah. They thought that was the solution to their problems.
If I may say so, it's a marvelous parable, in a sense, because here you have people that have come themselves from wretched, dire circumstances, committed themselves to an ideal, and then you degenerate into this business of owning other people. The progression toward an acceptance and a condoning of evil is really remarkable here. And that phrase, the one thing needful, I think emerges when the argument grows so strong, we must have slavery here. It is, yes, indeed, the one thing needful.
It's a chilling phrase,
isn't
it?
It is a chilling phrase. Mm-hmm. Let me take a moment from our conversation, Patty O'Toole, just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Patricia O'Toole, author of Money and Morals in America, published by Potter. Now, Patty, one of the most interesting chapters in the book actually talks about two men we've mentioned briefly, and I think we should focus on in some more detail at this point, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, America's two greatest philosophic talents, I would argue, who happened to occupy the same town at the same time.
Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing.
A village of 2,000 people?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know what the statistical probability is, but it's got to be off the map that that would happen. Now, they, of course, individually and together, put this question of money and morals in America in a very sharp philosophical context and perspective. But before we talk about that, should we think of their era as one that was really marked by the primacy of market forces in American society, just to get a sense of what they were up against and contending with?
It's a time when the market begins to consolidate. There are starting to be railroads, so you can bring raw materials from farther distances away. So everything is getting systematized and maybe not quite nationalized yet, but certainly regionalized. So things are happening on a bigger scale. They're starting to build factories in New England, and you need large amounts of capital to do that. So you have a fair amount of that kind of speculating going on. Financial enterprises like insurance companies and banks are getting much more like what we think of as banks and insurance companies today. There had been before this, for example, a lot of little local currencies and local banks who just wrote little drafts to each other without sort of any systematized clearinghouse function. So the market is very much more present and large in people's lives than it has been before.
You know, it's an amazing era because everything that you've said is absolutely true, of course. An era of national expansion, and also one in which the question of slavery, which we'll also be talking about in just a couple of moments, is not just coming to the fore, but becoming a major and divisive issue. Much can be said about each of these men and both of them together, but perhaps one way of trying to focus it is this. Where were they alike and where were they different? Let me see if I can hone that a bit. For example, in technology, the attitude toward technology, I had the sense that Emerson was more favorably disposed to it than Thoreau, but that there might be a number of more important differences between the two of them, as well as similarities.
Well, Thoreau, with his simple life on Walden Pond, you know, he didn't care much about what was going on in the textile factories just up the road in Lowell, whereas Emerson, who traveled a lot, was on the lecture circuit a lot. You know, he spoke about the railroad as the annihilator of distance.
Exactly, yeah. That kind
and of thing. He was much more optimistic about how technology could change people's lives for the better. Whereas Thoreau, you know, I think he took a train trip someplace and he calculated that the train trip cost him several days' wages, and he could have walked there for free, more or less, you know. So he was much more of an old-fashioned, he had no love of technology, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Oh, what he did have a love of course, was liberty to its greatest extent. And he gave us, in that context, the idea of civil disobedience, which he, of course, wrote so eloquently and artfully on. How important is that to the consideration of not just money and morals, but power relationships in the society?
Well, I think it's wonderful. I mean, it's a tool that Mahatma Gandhi used and Martin Luther King. And his basic point was that when a law is unjust, it's your obligation to break the law, to be civilly disobedient. And that is a form of power that the powerless can have. People who don't have influence in the legislature, don't have a lot of money, have the power of disbelief, and they have the power of disobedience. So,
power of disbelief.
Yeah. Very important example that he set for us.
I like that word, and I like the phrasing example, because this was a lived philosophy. I remember at one point he was jailed. Someone offered to pay his bail. He refused that because it was more important for him, on a matter of principle, to remain jailed.
That's right. He was behind in a tax. It was called a poll tax, not like the poll taxes that were later problematical for black voters in the South, but it was just a tax where male voters had to pay a certain tax every year. And he didn't want to pay it because he felt he was supporting the government of Massachusetts, which was had not taken, in his mind, the right position with regard to the Fugitive Slave Act. Mm-hmm. So this was his way of protesting that. He went to jail. And then a neighbor or a relative or someone paid his tax, mm-hmm. and the jailer let him out, and he was furious.
Bearing witness, it strikes me, is what he was doing.
He was bearing witness.
You know, Patty,
and kicking up a fuss.
And kicking up a fuss. And others have followed in that tradition ever since. If we were going to seek an issue to put at the crux of this major issue of money and morals in America, or a symbol of it, I don't think there's a more evocative or powerful one than slavery, which, of course, is the ownership of human beings by other human beings. And in the chapter that you've written about this, particularly in the way that you used original documents, the brutality of that experience comes through, and something that I think you've called the surplus brutality, where almost gratuitous violence could be used against people held in bondage.
Yes, I borrowed that phrase from a historian named Daniel Goldhagen, who used it in writing about the Nazis, that they weren't content to just beat people up. They had to, you know, be brutal to a gratuitous extent. And to me, I call this chapter Look Away, Look Away, a refrain from the song Dixie. And who was looking away was not only the population of the South, but the population of the North as well. Cotton, which is to say the product of slave labor, cotton was our most important export for the 1840s and the 1850s. Had we not been exporting cotton, we would have had an unfavorable balance of trade. This is never taken into account. You know, people imagine that that slavery was kind of a minority phenomenon, especially people in the North. They think, well, it happened down there, some bad people. And I remember the first time I read how many slaves there were when Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, and the number is 4 million. The number that was given in the book I was reading was 4 million. I thought, well, that can't be right. I mean, that's just way too high. So I did some research, and it wasn't right. It was 3.98 million or something. You know, it's a huge, it's a Holocaust-sized number, and then it doesn't take into account all the people who lived in slavery for centuries, all the people who died on slave ships on the way here. And yet this experience is still not understood. You know, the complicity of the North is still not understood.
Moving into our century, Patty O'Toole, you have a chapter about Henry Ford that's very interesting because, of course, he is known for the groundbreaking industrial role he played with the assembly line, the Model T, and so forth. But wage sharing, which you point out is one of his conceptions of a kind, if not a utopian society, at least a sort of utopian commonwealth of labor within his factory, is another of his accomplishments. But it also foundered. And I guess in every case, or at least in several of these cases, the question of why these things foundered or failed is one of the most riveting. And I'm wondering about this because he did provide wage sharing for his workers, company stores, all these kinds of things. But eventually it fell apart. And was it because it was too paternalistic?
Well, a couple of things. He started in 1914. He just announced one day that they would double the average pay in the factory to $5 a day. And I think if World War I hadn't come along in 1914, that would be what we'd remember about 1914. And the string that was attached to this was that you got $2.50 a day just for coming to work, but the other $2.50, you had to live a certain kind of life in order to qualify for it. So he had this brigade of snoops that went all over Detroit, and they'd come into your house and they'd say, George, now that woman over there, is she really your wife? Let me see the marriage license. And are you putting a little bit in the bank? Let me see the bank book, that kind of thing. So it was a very intrusive form of paternalism. But people mostly went along with it because they were paid so much better there than anywhere else. One thing that eroded it, though, over time was inflation. It happened at the end of World War I. There was big inflation, and they raised the pay up to $6 a day, but still it wasn't quite keeping pace. And then the Model T just gradually ran out of gas over time. I mean, now when people bring out a new computer, they hope it'll have a lifespan of a year before there's another big competitor to it. And the Model T had a 19-year run, basically.
Based on that alteration.
Yeah, it was pretty much the same. They just improved it within, but didn't really change it much in terms of how it looked. Mm-hmm. And that's unheard of now in our time. And Henry Ford just could not or would not see this coming, and so the whole thing just kind of fell apart.
Is there a difference here between having a moral concern and being moralistic about it? I mean, and the question, I think of Ford and Oglethorpe and Winthrop as kind of hard-charging believers that were, I mean, their very fervor almost seems to have, I mean, I get a sort of very narrow-focused, authoritarian kind of directiveness about this that might have ultimately worked against them.
Yes, I think people who are visionaries are often, they're charismatic in the beginning and they're offering something that's quite different, so people are attracted to them. But then when it begins not to work for one reason or another, they want to stick with their vision while people are saying, wait a minute, we need to fine-tune over here or we need to revise over there. Mm-hmm. So if you don't waver, that can be a quite dangerous position.
Well said, Patty. Actually, Patty, there was a visionary in the later chapters of your book that I think, in terms of the man and the subject and your treatment of him, form one of the most poignant chapters of the book. We're going to talk about Whitney Young. And I think I probably reacted much more personally to this particular chapter than any other in the book because of the nature of the man and of the times. I want you to explain him, but briefly put, he was head of the National Urban League. He died tragically in March of 1970. But he made his mark as a major civil rights figure in a very particular way. I saw him as kind of a diplomat of the movement, firmly committed to advancing civil rights, but trying to mediate between the power structure and the powerless. And that's often a thankless task. I sort of felt that he might have suffered from that somewhat personally as he tried to do it.
He deliberately put himself in a really difficult position. I call this chapter The Man in the Middle. Mm-hmm. And that's where he wanted to be. He never turned anybody away. You know, the National Urban League was largely funded by corporations. So he had to know how to deal with that white power structure. And when more militant black groups emerged, particularly later in the 60s, some white business people who had been supportive of the Urban League said, I don't want you hanging around with those roughnecks and those separatists. And he said to them, well, I'm going to listen to them. I'm going to be the one that they come and talk to. And that was it's a very tough way to be a leader because you've got people on the left accusing you of selling out, and you've got people on the right accusing you of not staying bought, you know. And I really admire him tremendously for what he did. He took a really hard line after the riots in the middle 60s. There was a big white backlash, of course, and calls for more police and throwing people in jail. And he might have softened his tone and, you know, tried to placate those people, but he didn't. He took a much harder line and he said, you know, no wonder these things happen. You look at the conditions people have been living in. This is right that this should happen. And this is what you get when you don't take care of poverty. And it was he died in 1970. He drowned. He was 49 years old, and it's a big, big loss.
Well, that's exactly my next question. How do you measure that loss? Because if you project that array of talents and that kind of personality into 1998, I mean, what would it be doing for us that is not otherwise being done?
I wonder about that all the time. You know, in the current political crisis. This seems to be a time when, I mean, we have a wounded president. A lot of people would look at it that way. And there are not a lot of other leaders on the scene. You know, there's great disenchantment with with public figures, and it's I really miss mm-hmm. Whitney Young and mm-hmm. Martin Luther King, and mm-hmm. it's a great loss.
Others have also remarked on the absence of heroes, I think is the word people use for these days.
Remember them, heroes?
Yeah. It's like that.
Old-fashioned concept.
Yeah, well, there was a Broadway play called Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich, and maybe we've gotten to that era now. Patty O'Toole, this has been a marvelous conversation. I want to conclude it by asking you a question about what you want people to take away from this book. And maybe the question is this. Are we to draw a moral, or are we to see these as a... And, of course, there are other chapters in here we have not talked about, but is there a moral to be drawn, or is this a series of American stories that we're just going to go on creating? We can look to for understanding, perhaps some wisdom, but we'll just be adding to them.
I think we will add to them, and also I wrote this as a series of stories rather than as a, you know, my sermon on this subject, because I think something happens between a reader and a writer in a story. You know, you sink into a story, you weigh it against your own experience, and you go away from it not only with the writer's point of view about it, but with your own point of view, and that's very much what I wanted to happen. As far as the moral to be taken away from it, the lesson, I hope it's that it's just plain wrong to let human beings go down the drain in a society as affluent as ours. And if we can't start with the grown-ups, let's start with the children. You know, we've had this big, long economic boom. We still have 20% of American children living in poverty. The only thing that's changed since 1989 is that there are 2 million more of them. And to start off your life poor, you're just behind for the rest of your life unless you happen to be that 1 in 100 who can break from the pack. And that's, I hope that 14.5 million poor children is a number large enough to implicate all of us, and it ought to be large enough to scare the daylights out of all of us and have us come together to try to do something about that.
Having read the book, Money and Morals in America, I join you, Patty O'Toole, in that hope, which you very eloquently expressed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, George.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Patricia O'Toole, the author of Money and Morals in America, published by Clarkson N. Potter. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler, our associate producer is Rachel Edmonds, and our audio engineer is Anthony Barber. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For more information, contact us at 202-691-4146. You can also listen to Dialogue on the web at wilsoncenter.org/dialogue. Email us on America Online at radiodial@aol.com. That's RADIODIAL@AOL.com.